Okay, just some review. We're looking at the American Revolution and the Bible, and this question, was the war justified from a biblical perspective? Last week, we did a little internal poll. Some of you weren't here for that poll, so you had no say in it. But if I remember right, out of the 23 who were here, all but 9 said, yes, it was justified, and the others all said they just were unsure. And that may be you here this morning, and if that's you, I completely understand it. Because in a poll of Christian leaders, 49%, yes, it was justified. 30-some percent said they were unsure. These are pastors and so forth. So you're in good company, if pastor is a good company. So I am looking specifically, I said we're going to be looking at, is self-defense justified? Because if we can establish whether self-defense is justified, then we can now move on beyond that to some of the other issues, which are, and they're not going to be up there, but I'm going to ask this question, what's so bad about tyranny? People talk about tyranny. Our founding fathers talked about tyranny. Well, what's so bad about it? Do you think it's bad? Okay. And then the other question is, who is the authority? Who is the king in the United States of America? But who is the king in our country? We don't have a king. Because a king is somebody who has, it's a monarchy. We have no monarchy here. So who do we treat as the king, the ultimate authority? We're going to have to address that. And then how am I to pray for those in authority? Those will all help us understand the American Revolution a little bit better. And so that's why I want to address that. So we're looking at Matthew chapter 5. I've got that up on the screen, where Jesus said, ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you that ye, and here's the three key words, resist not evil. But whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And so I mentioned that this is a source of much misunderstanding. And so I also went into a list of those who were pacifists during the American Revolution. Here's that list up on the screen. I know you don't have time to write those down if you weren't here last week. You'll probably have to see somebody else to get some of those names. But some of those are very well known, like the Quakers and the Mennonites and the Amish. You may not be familiar with the Moravians. They're number one. The Schwenkfelders, number 5, Sixth Brethren, Sandemanians, 7, Anglicans. Remember, Anglicans in general are not pacifistic, but those who were in the United States of America were pacifistic because at what country are we at war? With what country? Well, it's England. So the Church of England, they're kind of in a tight spot. Well, who do I support? I mean, Church of England. I'm from England. I'm a loyalist. And so many of them actually pulled away from the Church of England because they supported the war. And then the Seventh-day Adventists today. Seventh-day Adventists, of course, were not in existence back then. Then we looked at this quote from a book called Sacred Scripture, Sacred War by James P. Byrd. And he said this, during the American Revolution, pacifists often quoted the Sermon on the Mount when Jesus commanded his followers to turn the other cheek rather than resist evil. And he says, Matthew 5:38, it should be Matthew 5:39. That's his mistake, not mine. This text was a major challenge to patriots. They spent so much time refuting it that it became one of the most cited biblical texts in revolutionary America. And then he said, see the appendix, and it was in the appendix of the book that I had a copy of what he put there, which I will show you later, but not in reference to Matthew 5:39. So it was a source of much misunderstanding, a source of much misinterpretation. It has basically been very much misinterpreted, that passage, Matthew 5:39. So we have looked at the quotation, those two, the source of much misunderstanding and misinterpretation. And remember, Matthew 5:39, Jesus is quoting somewhere in the Old Testament. That's why I call it the quotation. But the passage itself is found in three places, and I'll be putting up here in just a minute on the screen so you can see it. I forgot to put it up there for you now. But it's in Exodus 21. So if you're still in Matthew 5, go back to Exodus 21. We're still reviewing. And we do have time since the morning message is a little bit shorter. You're welcome. And so the passage, Exodus chapter 21, verses 22 to 27. And we were looking last week at the original intent of what Jesus is quoting. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. What was God saying there in the Old Testament? And when Jesus quotes it, he says, you have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, is Jesus correcting the Old Testament law? Interesting question. When we went to the original intent, we're looking here again. Now I've got the quote, the passage up there for you in case you need to see it. And not only here, Exodus 21, 22 to 27, eye for an eye. The original intent, that whole chapter talks about slavery justice, verses 2 to 11, injury justice, 12 to 36, injuries caused by man are verses 12 to 27. That's where this, within that passage, 12 to 27, occurs this phrase, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Specifically, you go down to the very bottom up there, it occurs in injury to servants in verses 26 to 27, and injury to expectant mothers and the unborn, verses 22 to 25. So it's within that context that God had Moses write this in the law. When I was looking at the injury to servants and expectant mothers and the unborn, I quoted what the Good News Bible says. If some men are fighting and hurt a pregnant woman so that she loses her child dies, but she is not injured in any other way, the one who hurt her is to be fined whatever amount the woman's husband demands, subject to the approval of the judges. So what about the fact that the baby died? Good news for modern man makes it sound like that's no big deal. Okay? Good news goes on to say, verse 23, but if the woman herself is injured, the punishment shall be life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. That's good news, so-called. But then we looked at it and what it actually says there. Years ago, when I used to get the Greeley Tribune, long time ago, somebody had written in the Tribune and quoted this passage in support of a mother's right to abort her child. And so I went to this passage and studied it out. And part of my response I'm giving you today is the fruit of that study back then. Okay? Because when you look at this, in this struggle, I've got this up on the screen, the woman is hurt or smitten, which results in the premature birth of her child. It literally says in the King James, her fruit depart. Good News puts that as the baby dying. It's not what it's referring to. It's talking about her fruit depart. The baby is born. Okay? The word depart has nothing to do with the death of the child, the fruit, but as the Hebrew word denotes, to the going forth or the premature birth of the child. So the baby is born prematurely, does not die. Okay? Now, when you understand that that's what it is, that's what it means in verse 22, and then you look at verse 23 and it talks about mischief following. Well, I'm going too far. I got to stay right here. If any mischief follow, then thou shalt give life for life. Mischief follow could be mischief with the woman, the mother, or the child. So if the child is hurt, life for life, tooth for tooth, burn for burn. That's literally what it is talking about. Okay, so if the baby dies, what happens to the guy? Capital punishment. The baby died. Life for life. You see that? Does anybody have any questions about that? I want to make sure you understand that. Gio. Well, they use the Good News translation that mistranslates it. That's how they use it. So, to go back to the story about the Greeley Tribune, I wrote the article. And a week later, she wrote back and said, I never knew that. I was shocked that she admitted it. But she still tried to defend it, but now from another angle. But she saw clearly that that's not what the Bible was saying, that, you know, abortion was okay. So we're talking about original intent. Why did God write this? He's concerned about justice, folks. God is concerned about justice. So the main intent of the Mosaic legislation was to control excesses. Now, that's key. I'm quoting D. Martin Lloyd Jones here, as you can see up on the screen. And this is where we're picking up from where we left off last week. In this case in particular, it was to control anger and violence and the desire for revenge. Okay, so let's go back to the illustration of the mother who steps in because perhaps her husband is in a quarrel with this man and they're fighting. She steps in, she gets hurt, and the baby dies or she dies. What does the man want to now do? He wants to kill that guy. Is that just? But who decides that? See, here's the point. In the Old Testament, you go to the parallel passages. There's another passage in Leviticus I'm going to tell you about and Deuteronomy that says the judge shall decide. It is not up to that man to now kill this other guy. You killed my wife. I'm going to kill you. That is not right. That is not justice. That is vigilante justice. You did such and such. I'm going to do such and such. Let's say that in this fight, his wife loses her eye. That makes this husband mad. I'm going to knock your eye out. I'm going to knock your tooth out. I'm going to knock. He does more. Has he now violated what is said here? Yeah, eye for eye. Not eye plus tooth plus arm plus leg for the eye. You see how God is controlling excessive anger and excessive retribution here. But even then, it is not up to that man to decide it. This was written for the judges. Now, you judges, you cannot exact more punishment. It's eye for eye unless God allows for more punishment. For example, a thief breaks into somebody's house and steals. What was the restoration process? What had to be restored to the offended man who had his things stolen? Well, in some cases, he had to restore fivefold. God specifically lays that out. That's justice. If that man would just have to restore what he stole, where's the punishment, you see? So God says, okay, fivefold. But when it comes to injury, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Okay, so our natural instinct, human nature, if I may put it that way, is to get revenge, is it not? I mean, it is for me. That's our natural instinct. And not only just to get revenge, for it's not eye for eye, but it's off with your head for my eye type thing. That's what we will naturally want to do. So folks, this is a check upon sin. The object, I've got it up on the screen there for you, the object of this law was not to urge men to take an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth and to insist upon it every time. It was simply meant to avoid this horrible excess, this terrible spirit of revenge and demand for retribution, and to check it and hold it within bounds. That's from Lloyd-Jones. So, in Matthew 5, 38 to 39, Jesus says, I say unto you, but I say unto you, and it sounds like he is going to correct a mistranslation. He is going to correct a misinterpretation. And that's key. He is not correcting the law of Moses. He is giving the true interpretation, what God intended from the beginning. So don't get the idea that Jesus is there in Matthew chapter 5, as he's correcting and he says, we got that wrong in the Old Testament. God got that wrong in the Old Testament. Obviously, who wrote the Old Testament? Jesus Christ gave it to Moses in the first place. You say, Jesus Christ? Anybody having a comment about that? Was Jesus there? He's the Word of God. He is God. He's the angel of the Lord. He's the one who was in the burning bush. A theophany, an appearance in the Old Testament, a Christophany of Christ, an appearance of Christ in the Old Testament. So, there's the original intent. But now, look at this. The eventual practice. Okay, so you've got the original intent of Matthew 5, 38, 39, quoting Exodus 21. And now we know what was originally intended. But you know what this is like. How is this eventually practiced? Because sometimes we know the original intent, but after some years, we even begin to abuse what we know is right. I mean, let's look at it this way. In the United States of America, we've got the Constitution that is very clear on a lot of things. Look at the eventual practice today. Is it being abused? Okay, same thing was happening here. It's now being abused. By whom? Who is namely abusing, misinterpreting, practicing after many, many years something that's totally different than the original intent? Who namely are they, Karen? Well, no, not in this passage. I'm talking about this passage, Carol. Yes. In this case, it's the scribes and the Pharisees. And that's who Jesus is talking about, saying, you have heard that it hath been said. Because these people he's speaking to in a Sermon on the Mount, they say, I've heard the Pharisees talk about this. I've heard the scribes preach on this and teach on this. Yeah. And they give their eventual practice as part of it. So the enactment of retribution was not given to the offended individual. You hurt me, it's not up to me now to take out your eye because you took mine out. Although I would be tempted to take the law into my own hands. It is given to the judge who was responsible for law and order and the enactment of justice. The Pharisees tended to ignore that this was for the judges to decide. It wasn't up to them. So now, thinking modern day, somebody cut you off in traffic. How do you get back at them? Huh? Pray. No, you don't. What's that, Rod? Rear-end them. That's it. Did you just give them more than they gave you? Very much so. And here's the thing. This is not something that's going to go to court where a judge is going to, you know, hey, did you cut them off? Who's ever taken this to court? But so what do you do? When you get cut off and somebody offends you in traffic, what do you do? No, let me ask it this. What should you do? I'm saying, everybody's given me all these things of what you do. No, what should you do? Because I'm like this. My temper gets me and I'm like, you jerk, you know. But what should I do? Carol? You know, you used a word that is very key, personally. We're going to see in just a minute that Jesus is talking about personal insults. He's not talking about how government responds. So, China nukes us, okay? Well, as a nation, we're supposed to turn the other cheek, right? Oh, well, nuke our neighbor to the north, Canada, while you're at it. No, he's not talking about nations. He's not talking about groups. He's talking about personal insults. That's the whole context of what Jesus is saying there. Are you beginning to see a little bit more about self-defense here? And, you know, this is, okay, somebody has personally insulted me by cutting me off. You know what will really get to that guy? Is if he comes up next to you, smile and you wave. Oh, my. That's heaping coals of fire on his head. As Paul says in Romans chapter 12. Now, do I want to do that? Absolutely not. I don't. And that's why Jesus has to say it. Because my human nature, you know, I was going to say something I can't because it's being recorded. But I'm going to say it anyway. I'm going to pull my 45 out of my glove compartment, you know, and just show it to them. No, that's not just what you do. So the eventual practice was the Pharisees. They interpreted this as license to mete out justice themselves. And they literally turned a negative into a positive injunction. In other words, rather than taking Exodus 21 as a restraint, they took it as permission. Eye for eye, here I go. Now I have permission. No, Jesus is restraining evil. He's not permitting it when it's a personal insult. So, it was this eventual practice that Jesus is addressing in Matthew 5, 38 to 39. I hope this adequately helps you understand what Matthew 5, 38 and 39 is about, because now we're going to start getting into some American Revolution application. All right? So let's go to the actual interpretation, because that's where the problem arises. And I'm going to do interpretation by way of application. Again, Jesus did not give a new interpretation, but the correct interpretation. In other words, this was the intent of the Old Testament passage when God gave it originally, what we just covered. So let's look at how it was applied in the Old Testament. It was given in the Old Testament. Was eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth ever applied by judges, by God in the Old Testament? For the nation of Israel, for anybody else, was it ever applied? Let me give you some application. Let's look at Israel. Did Israel, the nation of Israel, God's people, did they ever practice self-defense as a nation? Absolutely they did. I found out there's another book I'm going to be reading more. It's called The Doctrine of the Ledger of the Lesser Magistrates by Matthew. And I'm not sure how you say his last name. It's Truella or Truella. And you'll see his name right there. The Doctrine of the Lesser Magistrates. He said this, in giving the law on Mount Sinai, we're looking at this on Sunday nights, God always punishes the perpetrator. He never disarms the citizenry. I thought, that's interesting. The perpetrator is always punished. Always punished. Those who do right are never, so to speak, disarmed. In fact, he looks at it this way. The census that is given in Numbers chapter 1 records every man 20 years old and upward in Israel as all that were able to go forth to war. Thus, they were all armed. You ever think of that? Think about what happens in 1 Samuel chapter 13. We need to go there. We're looking at Israel's self-defense, and we're looking at some illustrations or perhaps application of how they applied it in the Old Testament. In 1 Samuel chapter 13, this is when Saul has become king, and this is when Jonathan goes out with his armor bearer, and he does a little recon work. In chapter 13 and verses 19 and following, notice what it says. Here was the situation in Israel in that day. Are you there? 1 Samuel 13, 19. Now there was no smith found throughout all the land. It's not men who are named smith. It was men who would work with metal. There was no smith found throughout all the land of Israel. Why? For the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make them swords or spears. But all the Israelites went down to the Philistines to sharpen every man his share and his coulter and his axe and his mattock. Yet they had a file for the mattocks and for the coulters and for the forks and for the axes and to sharpen the goads. So it came to pass in the day of battle that there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people that were with Saul and Jonathan, but with Saul and with Jonathan his son, there was found. So who's the one who has the guns? Philistines have the guns. Who have they prohibited having guns? The Israelites. But Saul and his son Jonathan have guns. I'm putting it modern day. Here's what Truella says. The Philistines disarmed the Israelites. Weapon control was instituted. What do we call that today? Gun control. No blacksmiths were allowed lest the Israelites arm themselves. A disarmed people is the sign of a conquered people. A disarmed people is the sign of an enslaved people. Here's the thing. Was Saul attempting self-defense against the Philistines? Was Jonathan wrong in going to the Philistines and that crag in the rock that the Bible talks about and killing some Philistines in self-defense? He was absolutely correct in doing that. Israel had the right to self-defense. Another illustration. Have you ever heard of Sihon, king of the Amorites? Let's read about this. Numbers chapter 21. Numbers chapter 21. Most of those 20 years of age and older have passed away in the wilderness because they refused to go in to the land of Canaan as God directed them. And so now they're getting ready to go into the land of Canaan, but before they ever cross the Jordan River, on the east side of the Jordan, where they've been wandering, they come up against this man, Sihon. Numbers 21, 21. And Israel sent messengers unto Sihon, king of the Amorites, saying, "Let me pass through thy land. We will not turn into the fields or into the vineyards. We will not drink of the waters of the well. But we will go along by the king's highway until we be past thy border." So in other words, hey, guys, we're coming up. We just want you to know we've got 2 to 3 million people out here. And we just, please, let us just go through. Okay? Notice the response. Verse 23, Sihon would not suffer. He would not allow Israel to pass through his border. Furthermore, I'm adding with the word but, Sihon gathered all his people together and went out against Israel into the wilderness, and he came to Jahaz and he fought against Israel. Who's taking the initiative here? Who's being the aggressor? Sihon is. What's Israel supposed to do? Do they have a right to self-defense? Well, let's read about it. Verse 24, and Israel smote him with the edge of the sword and possessed his land from Arnon unto Jabbok, even unto the children of Ammon, for the border of the children of Ammon was strong. Did they practice self-defense? Absolutely. And Israel took all these cities, verse 25, and Israel dwelt in all the cities of the Amorites and Heshbon and in all the villages thereof. So they practiced self-defense. Who gave them that right to practice self-defense? Right there on Mount Sinai. There's another king. I like this name, Og. Somebody needs to name their son Og. King of Bashan, right? Same chapter, jump down to verse 33. And they turned and went up the highway of Bashan, and Og, the king of Bashan, went out against them, he and all his people, to the battle at Edrei. Who's being the aggressor here? Og is. And the Lord said unto Moses, "Fear him not, for I have delivered him into thy hand and all his people in his land, and thou shalt do to him as thou didst unto Sihon, king of the Amorites, which dwelt at Heshbon." So they smote him and his sons and all his people until there was none left alive, and they possessed his land. Did Israel practice the right of self-defense? Absolutely. So you see, we've got the quotation of Jesus and the passage he quoted, and now the interpretation by way of application with these two kings. At least, I mean, there are more and more. I mean, there's Exodus chapter 15, when the children of Israel go through the Red Sea. God is the one who practices revenge on Pharaoh's army and drowns them in the Red Sea. Well, you say, well, the Israelites didn't do it. But do you know what the Israelites called God in chapter 15 in the Song of Moses? The Lord is a man of war. Is God a pacifist? a man of war. Exodus 15 is the third most cited biblical chapter during the American Revolution. The Lord is a man of war became a... Let me take you to a chart first. Here's that chart that I showed you some time ago. That said the third most cited. It's the second. Exodus 14 to 15. Most cited biblical chapters in the revolutionary era, Exodus chapter 14 and 15. At least 75 citations that we know about of pastors who are going back to Exodus 15 and talking about the fact that the Lord is a man of war. Then there's an interesting one, Judges 5:23. Go back to the chart. Look at Judges 5:23 on the chart. Deborah, Jael, and the curse of Miraz. That is a very interesting quote by a lot of pastors during the American Revolution. They are quoting when Deborah and Barak go to fight, and there's something called the curse of Miraz. That was quoted so many times. That was used as the text of sermons during the American Revolution many, many times. Well, what does that say? Well, I'll put it up on the screen for you. Curse ye Miraz, said the angel of the Lord. Curse ye bitterly the inhabitants thereof, because they came not to the help of the Lord, to the help of the Lord against the mighty. Why would pastors and preachers cite that during the American Revolution? I'm just kind of curious what you would say. I mean, there are some pretty heated sermons with this passage. I'll tell you why. There were those who said, I'm not going to fight. And it was pastors who stood in their pulpits and really denounced the people who were sitting back and doing nothing to help with the war. You're like these people of Miraz. You are not going to the help. You're not helping with the war. You're not helping to fight this just cause war that God has involved us in. You people are cursed. I mean, they let them have it. George Washington purposely had chaplains in his army. And the book names his favorite chaplains. And they were the guys who got up there, the preachers who got up there, and just gave it to the men straight. Be courageous. Fight. And they went to this passage. They came not to the help of Israel. Is that what it says up there? Well, to the help of whom? The Lord. In other words, Israel was fighting. I mean, and this is in the book of Judges. What was Israel like in the book of Judges? Every man doing that which was right in his own eyes and so forth. And yet when it came time to fight and they did not come to the help of the Lord, curse was put upon them. I like what Byrd says in his book. Perhaps the inhabitants of Miraz were principal non-combatants, pacifists, equivalent to colonial era Quakers, for instance. This was a sensitive issue, particularly in the middle colonies. Let me just blank that out for a second. The middle colonies. Which was the largest state in the middle colony? Pennsylvania, where you will find most of the pacifists. So, this was a sensitive issue, particularly in the middle colonies. That's where the Ravens lived, the Mennonites, most of the Mennonites, the Amish, the Quakers. And preachers enlisted the support of the Song of Deborah in staging a full assault on Christian pacifism against pacifists who contended that a God of love would never support a violent opposition to evil. Finley, he's a preacher who preached in the war. He was familiar with a man by the name of Gilbert Tenney and a man by the name of George Whitefield. George Whitefield was a British man. Did George Whitefield support the American Revolution? as a British, as an Englishman, as I read his biography, it doesn't say much about it. He was torn. Why? He's British. But he could see why the Americans were doing what they were doing. Well, here's some of his best friends. Finlay, for example. Gilbert Tenney. And Finlay asserted that God's love is tempered with justice, and justice sometimes requires war. The real tragedy, now this is Byrd's opinion, was that these pacifists professed a love to peace because their efforts toward peace only led to conflict. These inhabitants of Meroz failed to realize that self-defense and a justified war fulfill the law of love rather than violating it. Kind of an interesting take on that. So I want you to see, the application is this. Israel self-defense. How did they apply it? Well, I gave you all those at least those four passages. You can go anywhere in the Old Testament. Anytime Israel was attacked, did they respond? Always responded. Self-defense. Does a nation, does a group of people have right to self-defense? Yea, do you have the right to self-defense if somebody is trying to break into your home? Is that a personal insult? It goes beyond a personal insult. And we're going to see something about that here in just a moment too. Now the application for God's vengeance. Who does God use to execute vengeance for crimes committed today? According to Romans 13:4. I'm giving you time to look it up if you need to. Who does God use to enact justice in our society today? Bruce? The government, specifically, what arm of the government? Karen? Okay, we're getting there. Getting there. I mean, let's read Romans 13:4. He is the minister of God to thee for good, but if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. Who are the sword bearers in our society today? Police. Under the government's jurisdiction, police are to execute what the laws say. And notice what it says. He is the minister of God, a revenger, to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. You know something you can say about our police? Rather than saying disarm the police and defund the police, praise God for the police. They are God's, what does it say here? He's the minister of God to He's the revenger. Okay? So, who does God use to execute vengeance? Well, law enforcement. Now, that puts a huge responsibility on government to make sure that the law is being broken. And whenever the law is broken, revenge takes place. People say, well, let God take revenge. You know, somebody breaks into your house. They steal everything in your house. You say, well, God's going to take care of him. Do you see the stupidity of our thinking sometimes? Well, I'll let God take care of it. Well, how does God take care of it? Who does he use? He uses men, folks. So when somebody attacks our nation, you say, well, let God take care of China. Yeah, it may take a missile that we shoot over there. That's how he uses us to take the vengeance he wants to have upon them. In other words, the right to self-defense. The guy's breaking into my home. The police are 5 to 7 minutes away. But a Glock is right there. What do you do? Well, he's coming in to say hello. Yeah, that's why he's breaking in. No, have him meet Mr. Glock. Do you have a right to do that? Absolutely you do. And we're going to see that here in just a minute, as it's even given in the book of Exodus. We might have time today. So here's God's vengeance. We were in Exodus 21. When murder takes place, presumptuous murders were to be executed. When I say presumptuous, I'm talking about when somebody came in with the intention to kill. There's something called manslaughter, where murder was not intended. Killing somebody was not intended. Well, if it was not intended, there's still justice that needs to be served, but it's not life for life now. But God's vengeance. How do we know that's God's vengeance in Exodus 21? Because he's the one who commanded that you, as a judge, make sure that vengeance takes place. If a man murders somebody, take his life. By the way, this precedes the law. This goes back to when Noah came off the ark. It said, he that sheddeth man's blood, his blood shall be shed. It even precedes the law. Now, Exodus 22:2. Let's go there very quickly. This is what I was going to get to if somebody breaks into your home. What did the law say about somebody breaking in your home? By the way, a lot of American law is based upon the law of Moses. Did you know that? Here's in verse 1 of Exodus 22, if a man steal an ox or a sheep or kill it and sell it, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox, 4 sheep for a sheep. But now look at verse 2. If a thief be found breaking up, he's breaking into your home, and you smite him that he dies, there shall be no blood shed for him. Somebody's breaking into your home. You don't know what he's... I mean, obviously, he's breaking in. Does he have goodness on his mind? No, you have the right to self-defense. The right to defend life, family, and property. God's vengeance. It's kind of interesting. Right before Moses is to die, here's what God tells. Here's the last thing, Moses, I want you to do. This is God telling Moses this. Avenge the children of Israel of the Midianites. Afterward shalt thou be gathered unto thy people. Isn't that interesting? This is one of the last things that Moses does. Is he is God's tool for vengeance upon what the Midianites did back in chapter 25 of Numbers. Moses, you avenge them. So does God use men to carry out vengeance? That's the whole thing I'm trying to do here. Yes, he absolutely does. He did it in the Old Testament. He does it in the New Testament, Romans chapter 13 and verse 4. Now, the application with Jesus himself. When Jesus was smitten on the cheek, when he was to be crucified in John 18, 22, what did he do? What did Jesus say to do if you're smitten on the cheek? Turn the other cheek. What did he do? Look it up, John 18, 22. What did he do? And my question is, did he turn the other cheek? And when he had thus spoken, one of the officers which stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, "Answerest thou the high priest so?" Verse 23, and Jesus turned the other cheek. Hello, is anybody awake? Is that what it says? Why didn't he? That's what he said to do. You see, now we're getting, by application, the true interpretation. Jesus answered him and said, "If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil, but if well, why smitest thou?" He challenges the man who smote him. He challenges him. So I get this quote from A.T. Robertson, a Greek scholar. Jesus himself protested when smitten on the cheek, John 18, 22. And Jesus denounced the Pharisees, Matthew 23, and fought the devil always. The language of Jesus is bold and picturesque and is not to be pressed too literally. Paradoxes. What's a paradox? It's a seemingly contradictory statement that may nonetheless be true. And this is a paradox. Paradoxes startle and make us think. We are expected to fill in the other side of the picture. One thing certainly is meant by Jesus, and that is that personal revenge is taken out of our hands, and that applies to lynch law. You ever watched a Western? And what do the cowboys do when some guy stole their cattle? They want to get out there and lynch this guy. They want to hang him up right there. What are they supposed to do? I leave that up to Marshall Dillon. It's not up to you. Call Marshall Dillon. Aggressive or offensive war by nations is also condemned, but not necessarily defensive war or defense against robbery and murder. Read out loud that last sentence. Professional pacifism may be mere cowardice. Now, this is written by a Greek scholar years ago. I just find that interesting. Jesus applied this, Matthew 5:39, to personal insults, not to groups or nations. Here's some lengthy quotes. This one comes from a man by the name of Campbell in his commentary, Opening Up Matthew. Just follow along. The principle of giving an eye for an eye, known as the lex talionis, was part of the Old Testament case law which provided safeguards against damage to personal property and possessions. The problem was that the rabbis of Jesus' day were misusing this provision of the law. They had extended this principle of just retribution from the law courts where it belongs to the realm of personal relationships where it does not belong. They justified retaliation and the taking of revenge by a law that was designed to prevent just that. There are occasions when we must endure wrongful suffering. You can find that in 1 Peter 2:20. Jesus' words are not a call to absolute pacifism, but to submission to God in every circumstance. This next one comes from Henry, Matthew Henry. Matthew 5:39 does not repeal the law of self-preservation and the care we are to take of our families. We may avoid evil, we may resist it so far as is necessary to our own security, but we must not render evil for evil, must not bear a grudge, nor avenge ourselves, nor study to be even with those who have treated us unkindly. Then he quotes these verses, Proverbs 20:22, say not thou, I will recompense evil, but wait on the Lord and he shall save thee. Proverbs 24:29, say not, I will do so to him as he hath done to me. I will render to the man according to his work. Again, who's this left up to do it? It's up to the judge. Proverbs 25:21-22, if thine enemy hunger or be hungry, give him bread to eat. And if he be thirsty, give him water to drink. For thou shalt heap coals of fire upon his head, and the Lord shall reward thee. Now when you compare scripture with scripture, you can get more of an idea of what's being talked about there. Now from Matthew Henry, the law of retaliation must be made consistent with the law of love. Nor, if any have injured us, is our recompense in our own hands, but in the hands of God, to whose wrath we must give place, and sometimes in the hands of his vice regents, where it is necessary for the preservation of the public peace. But it will not justify us in hurting our brother to say that he began. For it is the second blow that makes the quarrel. And when we were injured, we had an opportunity not to justify our injuring him, but to show ourselves the true disciples of Christ. Questions or comments up to this point? I want to finish with one last thing. Okay, here's a question. Why does Peter have a sword in John 18? Why does Peter have a sword in John 18, 10 and 11? That is your assignment this week. This is a Sunday school class, an adult Bible class. You are the students, I am the teacher, and I am giving you an assignment. Study this out. Why does Peter have a sword in John 18, 10 through 11? Why? Okay? Don't be talking to me this week about it. Don't be coming up to me and talking to me. Except for my wife. But I want you to find out, and you do some study. That's like us having a gun.